Today is Tuesday, October 10th. We're going to work on respiratory anatomy today.
Now on page 67, we're going to start talking about the respiratory system organs. So what I'm going to do is give you a tour of the organs as if we were a molecule of air traveling into your respiratory system. And I'm going to start you off with our external structures. In fact, this is the only external portion of your respiratory system, and that is the nose. From the outside, we have cartilage that forms part of the structure of our nose. We have the nasal bone as well. And then once air travels through the nostrils or nares, we now encounter coarse hairs on the inside of the nasal cavity. Those coarse hairs now are starting a line of defense against preventing, dust, debris, bacteria, viruses from traveling further into that respiratory system. Once we're inside the nasal cavity, we have these raised areas here. These are called the nasal concha or conchae, and there's three of them. There's a superior, middle, and inferior, right? And the grooves in between, they're called what? Meatus, good. These are also called nasal turbines or turbinates because it is their job to make the air go faster through your nasal cavity. And as the air travels more quickly, it spins the dust, debris, bacteria, and viruses against the sticky walls. What makes the walls of your nasal cavity sticky? Mucus. Good. So there is mucus inside your nasal cavity. That mucus is meant to trap all this stuff. And there are cilia there that line that nasal cavity as well. Those cilia are meant to push the mucus toward the back part of your throat in this direction, back this way. And the job of that mucus is to slide down the back of your throat, keep on traveling to your esophagus, where you can choose to either swallow it or spit it out. And then if it does continue on to your stomach's a pretty acidic condition environment, and that kills practically everything that comes down there, bacteria and viruses. So the goal of this mucus is to basically remove any possibility of getting into your lower respiratory tract and causing further contamination. Okay, so on your worksheet there, you've got hard palate and soft palate. Let's take a look at those. There are two bones that form the superior portion of your mouth, or you could also look at it this way. They form the inferior portion of your nose. This portion of the bone up here is called the maxilla bone. The back portion is made up of a different bone called palatine. Yeah. So both of those bones, maxilla and palatine bone, form a portion of your palate called
hard palate.
Yeah. So that hard palate serves as a great boundary between your nasal cavity and oral cavity. Think about it this way. You don't want to be eating pizza and having it mix with your mucus, or you don't want to have a cold and have that mixing with your pizza. So either way, you want to keep a boundary between your oral and nasal cavities. Not only does it keep food and air from mixing, but it also gives you a place to push your tongue when you talk and when you chew. So there's a great reason for having that boundary between those two cavities. The back portion is known as the soft palate. Is there any bone in that soft palate?
No, no bones.
No bones. And how about the tip end?
That's your palatine tonsils.
With that little piece hanging down of the soft palate?
Uvula.
Good. Uvula. Yep, so if you see those cartoons and somebody's screaming as they run toward the cliff, right? That's shaking you. You may wonder why that uvula is there, and in fact, when you swallow food and your uvula closes off your nasopharynx region, it keeps you from swallowing food that travels now up into your nasal cavity. So if you cough, if you swallow, that uvula is supposed to create a suction or a seal back here against that nasopharynx. Sometimes people have sleep apnea and they'll actually cut off that uvula. So kind of interesting that, there's no dangly piece back there at the end of the soft palate. But it actually has other reasons for there being there as well. It also is a place where that mucus drips from your nasal cavity down into the esophagus. Come in this way. All right, so in terms of nose functions, the nose is a great device to filter air. We, of course, have cilia and mucus and coarse hairs that contribute to filtration. There are capillaries close to the membrane surface in your nasal cavity. They help to warm and humidify the air that you breathe in. You may notice on a cold winter's morning, not that we're ever going to have those, you know, but on a cold winter morning, think back to one, right? You go outside, your nose is running a drippy, clear fluid, and you think, oh my gosh, am I sick? Not at all. Your cilia are just tired. Yep, so instead of pushing the mucus back toward the back of your throat, the mucus drips out as a clear fluid. So it just means that your cilia are unable to do their conveyor belt job. And of course, smell is a big job of your nose. The olfactory nerves are carrying information from your nasal cavity back into your brain. In terms of sinuses, we actually have four paranasal sinuses. You can abbreviate the bones they're located in as FEMS, F-E-M-S. That stands for the frontal bone, ethmoid bone. What's M?
Maxillary.
And S?
Sphenoid.
Yeah. So keep in mind the paranasal sinuses are in the FEMS, F-E-M-S. That stands for frontal, ethmoid, maxillary, and sphenoid. These are hollow parts of our bones. They do have a mucous membrane in there, and that mucous membrane does produce mucus. The mucus drains into your nasal cavity by way of tiny little ducts. If that mucous membrane becomes inflamed, what happens to the ability for mucus to drain? It can't, right? Not gonna drain. Yeah, so if you have inflammation in those sinuses and the mucous membrane becomes inflamed, you no longer can get the mucus to drain into your nasal cavity. So sometimes people experience sinus headaches or sinus pressure when they get inflammation in those mucous membranes in these cavities. You know, the frontal sinus is above the forehead. The maxillaries are right here through the cheekbones. But the ones that can also give you trouble are actually behind the eyes. And so people may not really feel like their head is stuffy, but they may have pain somewhere back behind their eyes. That could be ethmoid and sphenoid bones giving problems with sinusitis or just simply inflammation. So, all right. Any questions so far on the nose, nasal cavity, sinuses? Okay, so sinuses also lighten your skull. They do provide a resonance chamber for speech. You actually hear your own voice echo in your head inside those paranasal sinuses. So there's more to them than just being snot producers. Although that's about all we know them for, right? Let's turn our attention next toward the throat or pharynx portion of your nasal pathway or nose or respiratory pathway. The pharynx is actually divided into three regions. From superior to inferior, they are N-O-L. Nasopharynx, the middle region is called?
Laryngopharynx.
Good. And the most inferior?
Laryngopharynx.
Good. Let's tackle that nasopharynx first. Nasopharynx technically means nose throat. What set of tonsils are found in this region? Adenoids, yeah. Adenoids. And they're also called pharyngeal tonsils. But in fact, there's just one big mass of them sitting above your nasopharynx region, back here against this portion near your skull. So right nearby, you'll notice, is an opening right here. This is the opening to the auditory tube. You may have heard it called the Eustachian tube. Where does that tube take us? To the ear. Good. What's the purpose of that tube? Drainage. Yeah. So any fluids may need to drain from your inner ear down into your nasal cavity. They can drip into that opening. Now, this works both ways, because if there's bacteria sitting in your nasopharynx region, it says, hey, open doorway to the ear, and it can travel up that auditory tube into the ear location as well. So in little kids, because their heads haven't fully developed, their auditory tubes sit fairly flat, and it makes it easy for fluids not to drain and easy for bacteria to back up into that area. That's why little kids are so prone to having earaches and ear infections. when your face ages, there's a good part of aging, right? When your face ages, those auditory tubes take on a more angular setup, and so fluids can drain down into your nasopharynx region, and it's harder for bacteria to back up into your ear, giving you ear infections. So there is a benefit to having your face changed and your head changed as you get a little bit older.
Why do they remove your adenoids because of
the ear infection? Because they think that if they get infected, they can block this whole area and make it hard to breathe. So I think it's more that, and repeated infections can lead to scar tissue, and then they're not worth a hoot if they're full of scar tissue.
Oh, okay.
And then they'll enlarge and then block the airflow. Yeah. All right, so let's flip on over to page 68, talk about oropharynx there. So keep in mind, what we're trying to do is allow air to move down into our lungs that has been cleansed. We did a good job of that in the nose. We had cilia, we had mucus, we had coarse hairs. And now all of a sudden you talk about breathing in through your mouth and you don't have any of that cleansing activity. So if you think about your mouth, you have on either side of the back of your throat a set of tonsils in the oropharynx region. What tonsils are these?
Palatine,
good. And at the base of your tongue, another set known as?
Lingual
tonsils, good. So these are gonna help trap microbes and viruses coming in through the air that you breathe and through the food that you eat. This is an attempt to make sure that the air that gets down into our respiratory passageways is clean. So yet another reason to avoid breathing through your mouth, it doesn't have all the cleansing activities of cilia, mucus, and coarse hairs that we have in our nose. And then finally, you get to the laryngopharynx. Laryngopharynx is the most inferior portion of your throat. And at this point, we are down so low that we have to decide whether we're going to route air into the anterior trachea, or where would you send food?
To the esophagus.
To the esophagus, yeah. So at this point, you have a larynx, you have an epiglottis, and that is going to help us route air and food into their proper passageways. So I think of your laryngopharynx as the point at which we have to route air and food into their passageways. All right, speaking of larynx, our next organ, yeah, it is an organ, it is our larynx. And so what does it mean to be an organ? How do you have to qualify to be an organ?
System of tissues all working together for a function.
Good. Tissues working together for a particular function. And this particular organ actually has bone. It has cartilage, other connective tissues, epithelial tissues, nervous tissues here. So we have a number of tissues working together for a common goal. Let's start with the hyoid bone up here. We always talk about how unusual the hyoid bone is. Why? It's not attached to anything in terms of another bone, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we say it's unusual. It kind of looks like a bone that's just floating out there. You can feel it at the very top of your throat if you push up here at the very top of your trachea. So in fact, that hyoid bone is very important for swallowing and for the movement of your tongue. So, you know, it does have a very important function, but it is linked in with cartilages rather than with other bone. We've got a number of pieces of cartilage here. This shield-shaped is called thyroid, yeah. And thyroid cartilage has a piece sticking out. That's called the Adam's apple, yeah. And the alternate name for the Adam's apple? Prominence, yeah. Laryngeal prominence. So we all have thyroid cartilage. We all have laryngeal prominence. It just so happens that testosterone enhances the growth of that laryngeal prominence. So we say in males they have an Adam's apple. We know that right beneath that cartilage area is the thyroid gland. They actually don't show it on here, but it does sit inferior to that thyroid cartilage. Underneath that thyroid cartilage, we have a smaller piece of cartilage. What is this one called?
Cricoid.
That one's cricoid. Good. And then below that, we're technically leaving the larynx. This stuff down here, trachea. Yep. So we now encounter those C rings of the trachea. So from top to bottom, we actually have hyoid bone. We have thyroid cartilage with the laryngeal prominence. We have cricoid cartilage. And then we start with the C rings of the trachea. Another important piece of cartilage that you can see here is this thumb-shaped one sticking up. Okay, that one is known as
epiglottis.
Good. Good, that's epiglottis. And what is the function of your epiglottis? Good, prevent food from entering the trachea, right. I kind of think of it like a trash can lid. You know, it's going to rise up, cap off your glottis when you swallow, and then it slides back down into position. So if you put your hand on your trachea and swallow, you can feel your entire larynx move up as you swallow. That's allowing that epiglottis to cap off the trachea, and then it slips back down into position. Sometimes people get food on top of that epiglottis or liquid, and that creates that gag reflex, right? We cough, of course, to get that food or liquid off the top of the epiglottis. Other times, the food or liquid has traveled down into the trachea, and that also triggers a cough reflex to remove whatever's down and further into the respiratory passageways. All right. So inside, you can actually see the glottis is the opening. And some people, some textbooks say that the glottis not only is the opening, but it's also the vocal cords on either side. And in this class, we typically define the glottis as simply the opening between these two vocal cords. These vocal cords here on either side are folds of mucous membrane, and they vibrate to produce sounds. The speech that we make is actually a combination of the vibration of those vocal cords and what our tongue makes as well. I don't have good sound in here, but I'll turn this up as loud as I can. This is Steven Tyler from Aerosmith, and he's actually going to have a scope run down his throat, and you can watch his vocal cords vibrate, so pretty cool.
Steven Tyler, Aerosmith's lead singer. And you get a feel for why he and millions of others are wreaking havoc on a delicate instrument.
Okay.
Tonight, as Aerosmith performs, Dr. Steven Zeitels and his team from Massachusetts General Hospital will get a rare treat with the help of special monitoring equipment.
They'll see how this famous pair of vocal cords holds up to such extremes.
Dr. Zeitels, one time for my kids, what is this monitoring?
What we're going to be doing is looking at the vibrations on the skin of your neck, which is going to pick up the intensity of your voice. It's going to be picking up the loudness of your voice.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, doctor.
Okay. Into the abyss.
Into the great beyond. Dr. Zeitels.
Backstage, throughout tonight's concert, Zeitels will use an endoscope to examine Tyler's voice box up close.
Is he kind of a voice?
Try not to touch his sides.
Yep.
On in a high performance sphere.
Real time measures of a performer who is at the top of his game doing a live performance in front of thousands of people. That's the first, hasn't been done before.
To produce these kinds of sounds, Tyler's vocal cords are slamming together an average of 170 times a second. That's more than 500,000 times during the course of a concert. And nearly 1 billion times during the course of his 30-year professional career.
There's no part of the human body that likely sees these kinds of collision forces and shearing stresses, which is why vocal folds essentially wear out over time.
It's also why just months earlier, damaged vocal cords canceled much of Aerosmith's tour. Tyler could barely sing. Forcing him to undergo Zytel's knife.
That's mainly what I want you guys to be able to see with his vocal cords moving, which is pretty cool. So, a year or two ago, it's been a while now, you may have recalled that Joan Rivers passed away under a procedure on her vocal cords. And, you know, what they were doing was they were taking a look at her vocal cords to see if she had some damage done to them. And they had put her under some anesthetic to take a look at those vocal cords. She passed away under that anesthetic. And, you know, there was a lawsuit that ensued after that. And what they decided was that because her vocal cords had closed during that look-see of her vocal area, that prevented air from passing further down into her respiratory passageways. What could they have done to allow her to breathe if her vocal cords had stayed shut?
Open it.
Do a tracheotomy. And so that was part of why they, you know, sued, is they said, why didn't you do a tracheotomy? You know, my mom couldn't breathe. That's what Melissa Rivers had said. So, you know, unfortunately, if those vocal cords paralyze themselves shut and they don't open, then that is going to prevent air from passing further down into the respiratory passageways. So, yeah, tracheotomy would be necessary in that kind of a situation. All right.
So damage to the vocal cords.
They say if you're like a singer, especially somebody who does a lot of vocal, you know, talking, singing, that kind of thing, it can cause damage to them. And I'm assuming it's scar tissue that builds up on there.
I was
going to
say, there's a music teacher here, I think Ms. Hunter or something, she had like polyps or something on hers.
Ooh.
What I remember when I took her class like 5 years ago.
That sounds like it wouldn't be, I mean, that sounds like it would be something that they could take surgically off as well. Yeah. Okay, so we're moving on down. We are now making the transition from the upper respiratory passageways into the lower respiratory passageways. We are now moving into the trachea, and we also call it your windpipe. So this 4-inch long windpipe leaves the bottom of your larynx and travels down into your thoracic cavity. Let me kind of give you perspective for where we're at with this trachea. This trachea is sitting anterior to your esophagus. Your esophagus back here is sitting wedged up against the body of your vertebrae. If you swallow large pieces of food, you have nowhere for that esophagus to expand except into the backside of your trachea. Now, when you think about the job of the esophagus, it makes sense as to why we have C rings of cartilage. What do those C rings of cartilage allow for your esophagus to do?
Stretch.
Stretch, yeah. So that allows for the backside of your trachea to be utilized when you're swallowing by your esophagus. So we've got some muscle tissue back here on the backside of your trachea. The food that travels through then can expand into that backside of the trachea. So we have C rings of cartilage. I always think they look like horseshoes. And so they are hyaline cartilage. They're meant to provide a patent airway. Let me explain what patent means. Everything in your respiratory passageways, all the way down to the point of your bronchioles, is going to be patent, meaning it stands open. And the way we get these tubes to stand open is by propping them open with these cartilage rings. So it would be an extreme amount of work for you to have to breathe if your airways collapse. In fact, it would be more work than your body could do. So in order to prevent airway collapse and to allow for air to flow into your lower passageways, we prop them open with these cartilage rings like you see here in the trachea. By the way, what type of tissue lines the inside of your trachea? Yeah, pseudostratified. Good. It's ciliated, right? Okay, so in your nasal cavity, the cilia was pushing contaminated mucus back to your esophagus so that you could swallow it. But now that we're down here in the trachea, we don't want to push contaminated mucus further down into your respiratory passageways. This time, you want to push this contaminated mucus up towards your mouth. What happens when the mucus gets to your mouth? You either spit it out, you cough it, you swallow it, yeah. So you may not have any idea that you're doing this, but you're doing it all the time, right? And since we're talking about moving mucus, I do want to mention that your vocal cords don't have any cilia. So if mucus slides from your nasal cavity down into your vocal cords, you have to constantly clear your throat, right, or cough it to get it off those vocal cords.
So that's why we get hoarse.
That's why you get hoarse, exactly. And if you've got enough mucus, you get laryngitis, you lose your voice. Yep, all that fun stuff. Let's see. I wanted to show you this picture because we're now looking at the whole setup of the trachea. It is about a 4-inch long windpipe, and the last cartilage ring there is kind of a V-shaped cartilage ring. Carina, good. Why do we learn about that one?
Because it branches off the air.
Yeah, branches off the air into two bronchi. And in fact, a particular bacterium, if you take micro, loves to hang out there. Mm. It causes pneumonia. Yep, sure does.
I just didn't
want to bring it in.
Yeah.
I do want to mention on your sheet there under physiology, this is page 69, by the way, that the trachea has muscles in it. And these muscles can constrict or dilate the size of your trachea. And you'll notice that when we're under parasympathetic control, what happens to the size of your trachea?
It decreases.
It decreases, and your trachea constricts those muscles, right? And when you're under sympathetic control, what happens to the diameter of your trachea? Dilates, right? Hey, this is totally opposite from what blood vessels do under sympathetic and parasympathetic control. Why do you want your trachea to dilate under sympathetic control?
Get more air.
Get more air, yeah. So, of course, when you're stressed, when you're fight or flight, dilate the trachea, let more air pass into those lower passageways. So now we're going to start looking at O-rings. Rings that travel all the way around these bronchial passageways. We are going to branch off the trachea into a primary bronchus and a secondary bronchus, and then of course tertiary and then bronchioles. Let's focus on the primary bronchi first. These have the widest diameter of any of these branchings, but they're not the same. The right primary bronchus and the left primary bronchus are actually different in terms of their diameter. Which one appears to be wider in this picture?
The right
primary bronchus, yeah. See how it's wide and short? The left primary bronchus is long and narrow.
Is it because of the lung anatomy?
It's actually the heart.
Oh.
Yep.
Well, you would think the left would be.
Oh, yeah, well, because
the heart
has to
sit on top of it.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the reason I make the point about these two bronchi not being symmetrical is this. If you aspirate or accidentally inhale a piece of food, it happens to get stuck in the wider of the two bronchi. That is the right side. In fact, every few years, parent advocate groups go and say, we want to redesign the hot dog because hot dogs are a perfect plug for that right primary bronchus. So are coins. You know, if kids happen to aspirate a coin, and so are candies. Hard candies can very easily create a plug right over that right primary bronchus. If you need to dislodge a piece of food stuck in the right primary bronchus, what can you do? Heimlich maneuver, right. So in the Heimlich maneuver, we use the air already present in the lungs to force out whatever's plugging up that hole and hopefully dislodge it so that breathing can still occur. So from the primary bronchi, and I should emphasize here, a bronchus is a single tube, bronchi are the multiple tubes. So from the primaries, we split into smaller passageways known as?
Secondaries.
Good. So we've got smaller diametered secondary bronchi, and they branch again into tertiaries. What happens to the diameter as we continue to branch?
Get smaller.
Get smaller, good. we finally end up with the very smallest little passageways. I'll get you a picture here. And these are called bronchioles. And these bronchioles are so small that they start to lose their O-rings of cartilage. And so they're about a millimeter in diameter, so incredibly small. At this point, we also start losing our cilia. The cilia has been responsible for sweeping out dust and debris and mucus up to your throat. But now we're in such small areas that we don't really have room for those sweeping cilia anymore. We finally reach the very smallest parts of your respiratory passageways, and those are the alveolar air sacs that surround those terminal bronchioles. What activity occurs now that we have a very thin layer of simple squamous?
Gas exchange.
Gas exchange, good. So you'll notice that we are now moving down there to the bottom of your page. The bronchioles are part of a respiratory tree. Okay, and if you flip on over with me to page 70, there are the alveoli, very thin walls. And they are surrounded by capillaries called pulmonary capillaries. So which gas are we going to drop off in the lungs?
Carbon dioxide,
yeah. Get rid of the CO2 and pick up oxygen. All right. So this kind of gas exchange occurs in your lungs. Pulmonary capillaries drop off CO2. They pick up oxygen. Let's take that oxygen for a ride. The oxygen travels from pulmonary capillaries to pulmonary venules, to pulmonary veins, to the
left atrium.
Yep. So that's the route we're going to take that oxygen. And then, of course, pump it out through the aorta and let it travel through systemic circulation. So we are looking to do this gas exchange when we finally get to the point of having very thin walled alveoli and those capillaries. I should mention that those alveoli are basically the thickness of a soap bubble. There is a simple squamous layer of tissue there, and that's pretty much it that composes our alveoli structure. Laid out, your alveoli would cover the area equivalent to a football field. Who did this math? I don't know. But that's an overwhelming amount of surface area over which we can perform gas exchange.
You say it's got carbon dioxide and
yeah, drops off CO2 and picks up oxygen.
Okay.
Drop, yeah, we're going to actually unload, the technical term is unload CO2.
I'm thinking coming in, oxygen being dropped off to them instead of the body dropping off.
I got you, so it's like a reverse, yeah. So just another view of how those alveoli work with pulmonary capillaries. The capillary is a single cell thickness. The alveolus is a single cell thickness. So only thing separating them is a basement membrane in between, right through there. And these gases simply diffuse. Oxygen diffuses from the air that we're breathing across these two membranes and into the pulmonary capillary. We say we're loading oxygen into the bloodstream. Likewise, we're ready to get rid of CO2. It will diffuse from the pulmonary capillary across the capillary membrane, alveolus membrane, and then out into the air that we exhale. So we say that we are unloading the carbon dioxide while we are simultaneously loading the oxygen. And this is just simple diffusion. There's no ATP involved here. It's just gas exchange by diffusion. Let's see, a couple other things there I want to point out about your alveoli. Let's get this picture here. There are special cells scattered among your simple squamous epithelial tissue that make surfactant. These specialized type 2 alveolar cells secrete an oily secretion that helps to keep your lung tissues from sticking together. If you think about this, it's a really important function to have. Going way back into Bio-210, what do water molecules have the tendency to do around each other? combine and stick, right? Okay, so if you've got water-coated membranes in your lungs, they're going to have the tendency to want to stick to each other. So in order to prevent them from sticking to each other, our lungs are coated on the inside with something that I think of as Pam cooking spray. You know, it's a moist, oily secretion. Oil and water don't mix, and this keeps those lung tissues from sticking to one another. Why is this so important? Yeah, got to have them to expand. And if your lung tissues stick, what happens to your lungs? Collapse. Yep, they'll collapse. So little babies that are born prematurely may not make enough surfactant. They can intubate them and give them a manufactured surfactant to keep their lungs inflated until their bodies begin to produce enough to keep their lungs inflated on their own. So surfactant is really important for keeping our lungs inflated. And in this picture, you'll notice, hey, no cilia, right? Okay, so we have no way to sweep out dust, debris, or bacteria that have made it this far into our respiratory passageways. What instead do we have here to prevent infection?
Macrophages,
good. And what do macrophages do for us?
They eat bacteria.
They eat bacteria, right. So if you bacterium are lucky enough to make it this far into our respiratory system, then we may eat you. Okay, so that's the only way we can get rid of stuff if it's made it this far into your respiratory passageways. Let's talk about the lungs for just a moment. You know, we've spent time now talking about the pathway to get the air into the lungs, but the lungs themselves are made up of an elastic tissue that is great not only for stretching upon inhalation, but very important for recoil upon exhalation. So that elasticity is a very important feature of lung tissue. Where do we find the apex of the lungs?
Top,
good. These pointed regions. And what is the portion that rests on the diaphragm?
Base.
The base, good. There is a pair of pleural membranes that cover your lungs. The outermost is attached to your thoracic cavity wall and known as?
Parietal pleura.
Parietal pleura, good. And of course, the innermost layer is known as?
Visceral pleura.
Visceral pleura. These two layers secrete a type of fluid called?
Serous
fluid. Serous fluid, good. And the function, of course, is to reduce friction around your lungs, lubricate, and if that tissue or membrane becomes inflamed, those serous membranes can now experience pleurisy. If a person has pneumonia, for instance, that can lead to a case of inflammation and pleurisy around those lungs. All right, so at the very bottom of your page, I just wanted to introduce two important muscles for breathing. In this picture, you can see the diaphragm. It's a dome-shaped muscle that sits underneath the base of the lungs. It works both involuntarily and voluntarily. It is a primary mover in breathing, and there's a second set of muscles between your ribs that kind of involve themselves in inhalation. They're called the intercostals, right? Internal and external. Good. Just want to spend a moment going over some disorders. They're on page 71. Do y'all have questions so far today? This stuff makes pretty good sense. Okay, at the top there you've got respiratory disorders. Some of these disorders affect the pleura surrounding the lungs on the outside. We place pleurisy in this category, pneumothorax, pleural effusion all go in this category. However, if we're talking about the passageways inside the lungs, we classify those as a different type of disorder. Common ones that we're going to talk about are things like asthma, chronic bronchitis, emphysema, which of course lead to COPD. Let's talk about, do you want a picture of that? There you go.
I thought you were moving out.
Oh, it doesn't like that light back there, does it?
Mm-hmm.
It's going to make you walk all the way to the front and take it. Anybody else? Y'all good? Okay. So pleurisy is an inflammation of the pleura around the lungs. It can come from pneumonia. Sometimes pneumonia is hard to treat. Untreated pneumonia can lead to irritation and inflammation of those pleura. If you treat the underlying issue, like pneumonia, then you can probably get that pleurisy to go away. Anybody had pleurisy before? It's a pretty painful disorder. I have not had it. I do understand that a lot of times people do get it following some other respiratory condition, and it's a dull or a sharp pain breathing in or out or both. So it's basically those membranes that are rubbing and inflamed past one another instead of smoothly gliding past one another. Our second condition affecting our pleura is a pneumothorax. This is technically telling you what's happening, what's wrong here.
Air in the pleural cavity.
Air in the pleural cavity, right. So if you put air in the pleural cavity, notice how it's taken up a good deal of space here. And look how small that lung has become. Going to collapse, yeah. I always think these look like little mandarin orange slices, don't they? So they have to remove the air to allow that lung to reinflate. We're working with negative pressure inside those pleura, and if there's positive pressure, such as air that has escaped into that area, then those lungs will not reinflate as long as there's air in that space.
That's why they put chest tubes in the area like
that. Yeah, yeah. And very similar is pleural effusion. This is kind of like cardiac tamponade. It is excess fluid in the pleural space between the visceral and parietal layers. It can be fluid from, say, infection. It can be blood, pus. So whatever the case is, again, they have to chest tube, pull this fluid out, allow the lung to reinflate. Otherwise, this puts a squeeze on the lung, and it's not able to inflate with air.
So the lung just kind of, after they put the tube in, it kind of just inflates itself back. You know, it does it by itself.
It should do it by itself.
Because air will start going back in there.
Yeah.
After the chest tube.
After the chest tube, yeah.
So
Ashley.
What's the difference between
the
pleura effusion and
hemothorax? Hemothorax is just, it's technically referencing the blood in that thoracic cavity. Pleural effusion can be things other than blood. This could be pus or excess fluid from an infection. Lung cancer could lead to the pleural effusion. So I'm assuming the hemothorax is just being very specific.
Okay.
All right. Just to wrap up today, a little bit here on restrictive and obstructive disorders in terms of the respiratory passageways. And real easy to keep this straight, O for O. Obstructive disorders have trouble getting the air out of the lungs. Okay, restrictive disorders have trouble getting the air into the lungs. COPD, of course, is a classic obstructive set of issues. It includes asthma, bronchitis, emphysema. There are some restrictive disorders that we're not going to talk about. Pulmonary fibrosis is scar tissue in the lungs, and in that case, a person may not be able to inhale properly. Obesity can also put the squeeze on the chest cavity and also make it difficult to breathe in. Anybody need this slide? Just real quickly, wanted to show you emphysema. These people are called pink puffers, and the reason for this is their alveoli have collapsed, oftentimes due to smoking, and their lungs have lost their recoil ability. A few minutes ago, I mentioned how important it was for lung tissue to be able to recoil back to its original position, and in the case here, this guy is actually having to puff the air out of his lungs. He's having to work it out. Normally, exhalation is a passive process, and here he's having to physically work and force that air out. So notice the muscle wasting in the chest cavity due to that overworking of exhalation. Okay, another guy. Notice the way he's sitting. That's classic for emphysema. And yeah, and here's, you know, the alveoli are collapsed. Smokers on the right. Smokers on the right. Okay. And then, of course, asthma causes inflammation of those respiratory passageways. And blue bloaters are often called the bronchitis patients because they are bloated. Notice their chest is not thin. And unfortunately, because they can't exhale the air out, it's due to the bronchitis this time, not the alveoli failure, they're going to have a blue tint to their skin, more so than emphysema patients are going to have. We can pick back up here and just hit a little bit of COPD in class on Thursday, and then we'll start talking more about respiratory functions.